You are listening to a talk given at the Brisbane City Bible Forum. We hope you enjoy the presentation.
Before we get to your questions, or as the questions are arriving, we thought we'd have a little bit of a chat about the documentary. Simon, you guys have been kind of crisscrossing across the country. You've been all over the place for screenings of this. How's it been received around the place?
Well, the people who speak to us say nice things about it. No, it's been well received, I think. We've been very pleased with that. And especially in terms of just the kind of mainstream people, not just people coming out of churches, but it's certainly had what we hoped it would do, which is start off good conversations. And so we hope tonight's one of those, at the beginning of the conversation for lots of you and friends. It's been really good. We've had some good media and, you know, film critics who think it stacks up. So it's been good fun too.
My favourite is one atheist film critic from Melbourne said it, at the end of it, he is less anti-religious than he was before.
It was taken as a positive, for sure.
How did you come up with the idea in the first place? Were you kind of just sitting around brainstorming what's the next project, or how did you come up with it?
Well, we were deep into another documentary, actually, that we had pretty much written, looking at the five major world religions, and we were preparing to go and film it. And it was really through a bunch of experiences, some lost debates, and just tuning into where a lot of Australian, mainstream Australia was, that we thought the more pressing question was whether Christianity has damaged the world irreparably. So we shelved the world religions documentary, or at least paused it, and started from scratch this idea. And I remember it really just started from a conversation Simon and I had in a car on the way back from Canberra, I think. And we were just going, oh my goodness, I think we need to drop this documentary we've been doing and do this. And it was just sort of a moment along the Hume Highway. And I'm glad we did, because it does seem that it's a more pressing question. Not that the world religions are going anywhere, so maybe we'll get around to it.
For the love of God, why that title?
Well, we've worked hard to get the right title. I think
it was
Bill's
wife
came up with the title. We'll credit her with that. You know, obviously that can be interpreted, you can interpret that one way or another. People did these things for the love of God, or you might be exasperated as you consider the behaviour of people across the years who claim a Christian faith and not really live that out. So yeah, that's the meaning of it.
Right. You went to some pretty cool places. Hawaii, India, United States, Europe, Australia. You got some favourite spots you went to?
There were lots of really interesting places, for sure. Hawaii was spectacular, and a bit, it was full on that filming day in Hawaii, and as you saw, we do all our own stunts in these films, and some training. Ride those mules down that slippery, treacherous, muddy path. Just before that, as we got on top of it, I got on these mules, we got the message to come through that a tsunami warning had been issued from down below, and we had to call the whole thing off. So we were there in the pouring rain and trying to get set up, and we had to think, what are we going to do? Because we didn't have a plan B. We thought we were going to have to come back sometime, because we're on our way back from the States. Anyway, you'll be relieved to know, tsunami was called off and we braved and ploughed on. And it was an hour and a half down that hill, the steepest of the largest sea cliffs in the world, it's quite something, and it's on Molokai. And the plan was to fly out of there in this very small plane, and it was too much fog, so we had to ride the mules back up that hill again. So anyway, that was full on. The Flossenbürg concentration camp, for me, just very quickly, when I think about the years I've spent studying German church and under Nazism and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and you can read that in books, but when I stood there at the spot where he was hanged, in this beautiful little town, And yet the darkness of that place, the spiritual darkness that I felt, and the tragedy of the whole thing, not just his story, but the broader story, was really affecting. I was deeply moved by that.
John, for you, any particularly moving moments or favourite places?
Well, for me, all the really old stuff is great. So I'm happy when I'm around old rocks, ruined buildings and ruined temples. So for me, Delphi in Greece was awesome. But in terms of moving, there was one that really stood out to me, and it's actually the opening scene, which you may not remember, but it's in the outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Great platform there. One of the holiest sites in Islam, and the site where the Crusaders first slaughtered men, women, and children in the name of Jesus. And so to stand there was very confronting, because the great promenade there was, according to our primary sources, filled with blood. It was such a massacre. And I had to deliver the lines with my Muslim guide standing just off camera. And by the time I got my lines right, she had a tear in her eye. That was very confronting. You know, this is 900 years later, and for Jerusalem Muslims, this is still an open wound. So yeah, I felt the force of that. And in fact, I just recently took a tour group, 40 or 50 people, and we stood on that very spot, and I felt it all over again. It's very confronting to be in a place you know has damaged the reputation of Christianity, probably irreparably for many.
Certainly the documentary touches on some pretty horrific things that were done in the name of religion and Christianity. Wouldn't we delve?
Can I just say,
yeah.
I always need to say this. What you saw tonight is about a third of the whole thing. So we've been making this for about 3 years. There are 4 one-hour episodes available. I don't know if that fills you with joy or not. but if it does, please go to publicchristianity.org or betteranworse.film where you can see those, as well as every segment that's available as well, which you can use and take it up wherever you want to use it and share it with your friends. So I'd love you to see that this is a very compressed version of the whole thing and you can get access to the rest. There's my little ad.
Absolutely, we'll give you some ways to get links and follow-up information towards the end as well, so stay tuned for that. We're going to go into your questions now, and the first one is this. In Northern Ireland, there were seeds of religion in the conflict, were there not? If the cello is capable of being played so poorly that it is devastating to the lives of others, wouldn't it be better to take away the cello to stop the harm it can bring? Do you want me to read that again, or you got it?
Yeah. Well, actually, I would say that, to continue the analogy, the cello tune is probably the only thing restraining such behaviour. The question is, did it do it successfully in all cases? And the answer is absolutely not. But anyone who knows the Northern Ireland conflict well knows that it was principally a political and geographical conflict, only overlaid with religion. It basically, the indigenous Irish were all Catholics, and they were fighting against the transplanted Brits, or Scots and English, into the north of Ireland, who were all Protestants. And so it was a land conflict that happened to be divided by Catholics and Protestants. And, I mean, if you study it, it's pretty clear no one was arguing over the theological differences between Protestants and Catholics. The Catholics were shooting Protestants and saying, shame on you for not believing more in Mary. It just was not part of the conflict. But religion is a very good overlay to justify it. God is on my side, we'll beat them. And that can't be denied. But to the question of whether if you take away the teaching of Jesus or the impact of Jesus, wouldn't it be better? I'd say absolutely not, because you certainly didn't need that to get wars and conflict going. Greece and Rome were doing fine without Christianity on the torture, bigotry, hatred, warfare front. it's sad but not surprising that Christians sunk to the most base level of human beings. But that base level is universal. What isn't universal is the idea that you ought to love your enemy.
Can I just add something to that too, just mentioning Northern Ireland. Before we went to Belfast to film that segment, I thought it mostly wasn't about religion. Having been there and talked to the guys who were involved, like Jim, the taxi driver, I think it has absolutely almost nothing to do with religion. In fact, it was even more so than I originally thought. These guys who were involved in the conflict will say to you, you know, we won't turn up to church on Sunday. This was nothing. They sat themselves, it had nothing to do with religion. But it's a fascinating kind of current example, isn't it? And it's so, the crew who we took to all these places found that to be one of their most, they enjoyed that the most, because everywhere you went, from the taxi to the airport, you talked to the guy whose brother went to jail for murdering someone in the Troubles. And the taxi back to the airport, you talk to a guy whose sister had her leg blown off when she was in a pub and a bomb went off. Jim, who's in the cab, he was shot by a British soldier when he was 13 years old out on the street, twice. And he's got a cripple in his hand because of that. So it's a very live thing. It's a great example of the sorts of things we're talking about. The way it's almost always a lot more complicated than just a straight out religious struggle. You can't get a contemporary.
What was that line that was used about, kind of summarising it, what religion was there but it wasn't religiously motivated or something? Is that kind of...
Well, Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, says that, you know, these things are often religiously cloaked but not religiously motivated, was his claim.
Yeah.
It's an arguable point, but I think there's a lot of evidence for that.
Mm. From Northern Ireland to Germany. How far should Christians take Bonhoeffer's example? I assume they're talking about either. Well, I'll let you have a go at answering first before I make assumptions.
this is an extreme example. John's smiling. I always get into trouble for this section.
We had endless conversations about Bonhoeffer. So Simon will give you his view.
And then we'll move on to the next question. I think for Bonhoeffer, the question's talking about how extreme this is, and it follows on after we've been praising Martin Luther King for his non-violent resistance, right? So I get that, the complexity of this, it's ethically complex. But for Bonhoeffer, it's an absolutely extreme thing for him, a Lutheran pastor drilled into these people to be sort of obedient to the state. It's a sort of theological point that's so strong in his tradition. For him to do anything like this is a very extreme thing. And of course it was an extreme situation. I think Luther's kind of sin boldly idea fits this, where he's saying the overriding ethic is love of your neighbour. And my neighbour here is being crushed, and the only way to stop that, I think, is to, you know, as he says there, put a spoke in the wheel of the thing that's crushing the victims. And he does that, not relishing it, but thinking that in this extreme situation it's the only thing that he can do. Now, you could argue about whether it was the right thing, but I think it's hard to argue about the motivation. I think it was that kind of ethic of love that was behind it. And Bonhoeffer's a really interesting character for lots of reasons, but especially because of how clear-sighted he was about this right from the beginning. There's a whole lot of people who eventually became opponents of the Nazis, like Martin Niemöller, theologian Karl Barth. They say Bonhoeffer, more than anyone else, saw right at the beginning the idolatry of this movement and was speaking against it right from the start. So I do think he's an interesting character in the way he's able to stand sort of a little bit away from his own culture and critique it. In a way that I think is very, very difficult to do.
I won't take a contrary view in public. but Simon does raise, I think, something
it's worth understanding about
history. Worth understanding about history. Thanks, Simon. The history of warfare. And in virtually all human cultures throughout history, you didn't need much pretext for warfare and violence. Land, getting more land, was perfectly good reason. Honour for your nation or tribe, perfectly good reason. Money, perfectly good reason. Revenge, perfectly good reason. Okay. And so Greeks and Romans operated on this principle and so on. The really unusual thing Christianity brought into the West was to dismiss all of those normal reasons for military conflict. And the just war tradition that grew up only in the West basically said there's only one good reason for war. So Christianity has not been absolutely pacifist for most of its history. It simply said that you can't go to war for honor, you can't go for revenge, you can't go for land, you can't go for money, but you can for love. You can engage in violent conflict for love, that is to protect the other, to protect the vulnerable, to stop terrible evil occurring to people who can't help themselves. That's the only valid conflict. And I do agree with that theory. And so, to the degree that Bonhoeffer saw that his activity was in that frame, it makes sense.
So you're kind of saying it's complicated, like almost everything that you addressed, but we can see that Bonhoeffer was trying to act out love and that responsibility to protect.
Yep.
But could we debate it as to how that all worked?
Yeah, and not all Christians would think that was the right thing to do. But nonetheless, that's what he was doing.
Let's move on. Politics. Do abuses of power perpetuated by Christians make you question whether Christians should be involved in secular politics? The abuse of power, should Christians be involved?
No. It doesn't make me think Christians shouldn't be involved in politics. Because again, the abuse of power, corruption, lies, all that is universal. Everywhere in politics, in all human cultures, that's what the human heart does. The problem isn't religion or irreligion, it's the human heart. And so are there special evils perpetrated by Christians? Or when they participate in those things, are they simply falling away from their Christianity, not obeying their Christianity? I think the latter is the case. And so I'm perfectly happy for Christians to be involved in politics as citizens. I don't think there's a special reason for Christians to run the country. I can perfectly happily vote for an atheist prime minister. No worries. If I think their policies are for the benefit of the... So I'm not one of those Christians who wants Christians to be in parliament, you know, to sort of dominate the culture. I don't think that's a good plan. But it's lovely. I love it when I bump into doctors who are Christians, and politicians who are Christians, and plumbers who are Christians, and teachers who are Christians.
That said, I do think there's been very often a terrible result when a political party might capture or hijack Christianity or Christians for purposes other than things that are Christians. I think that's happened. We see examples of that. Probably don't need to explain those. And I do think that's a bit disaster that happens. But in terms of having Christian people engaged in the community in every way possible, serving the good as much as they can do that and try to do that, it should be applauded.
Yeah. So you want them to play in tune?
Yeah, in tune if they can. I mean, I have some sympathy for the Christian politicians because I think rightly they're held to that standard and it's very hard to live up to it because it's a game of compromise, it's a kind of principled compromise. And it's very, very hard to get it right.
Thanks. Let's stick in the 21st century. What do you think is better or worse about the church in the 21st century of Australia? So today, what are you seeing is good and bad about the church at the moment?
I'll let Simon go. I don't know much after AD 500.
Look, one thing we sometimes do talk about is the fact that what are people going to say in 50 years' time when they look back at us and say, well, those guys are even Christian. Like, what were they doing? There will be blind spots. And partly that's what I was talking about with Bonhoeffer. He did seem incredibly good at critiquing his own culture. It's very hard to do that. And so blind spots are necessarily blind spots, right? So you're missing things. And it's good to try to have a bit of self-reflection for people who see this film who are Christians. And it'd be great if they took a bit of time to think about what are the things they're not seeing about themselves. It's good for us to do that for sure. Definitely things like the way our whole culture has, including people of faith, been captivated by consumerism, I think is a big one. There might also be questions around, like Christians are playing important roles in this, but questions around how well we've been able to welcome people from places where they're in great need and suffering, and we haven't maybe done a great job of that too.
Yeah. And okay, well, similar theme, and it's to do with how you chose what to include and not include in this, and a question directly, what about the church's role in harbouring child abuse?
Well, I will speak to that. I mean, we sat around and had a lot of conversations about whether and how we would tackle that topic in this documentary. And in the end decided that we wouldn't and shouldn't, partly because it would seem out of place in a historical documentary, and partly because it would only get 7 or 8 minutes, since everything, you know, the history of the Crusades gets 7 or 8 minutes. And that wouldn't seem to be to trivialize what is too important. So we just decided that we wouldn't tackle it, but it would be the obvious elephant in every room. And the same thing applies that we've tried to say throughout the whole documentary, and that is, you ask the question, when someone abuses a vulnerable child and then covers it up and others are complicit in covering it up, is that following Jesus Christ or is it disobeying Jesus Christ? And I think everyone can tell at 100 paces, no matter how skeptical you are about Christian faith, you know that that is a contradiction of the very core of the Christian faith. If the center of the Christian faith is that God loves human beings and gave himself on behalf of human beings in Christ, then the idea of harming the vulnerable and then covering it up is just a blasphemy. I probably have no other words than that.
Speaking of Australia, our history, there wasn't a mention of the stolen generation in the documentary. What was the church's role then and since?
Well, the church did play a role in the stolen generations. To the church's shame. And without excusing it, the reality is, who was running orphanages, who was doing poverty relief? It wasn't secular society, it wasn't secular groups. And so it was natural for the government policy, it was a government policy, of removing generations, a despicable government policy. It was just, in their head, natural that it would be church groups that would be able to look after the kids in orphanages. And that was the church's role in it. And I think all the denominations that were involved apologised for the stolen generations years before the wonderful apology that Kevin Rudd gave on behalf of the government.
Someone has asked about whether humility really was an original Christian value. How do you respond to the objection that humility is also known as a virtue in other cultures?
I would say, can you provide evidence? What we tend to do in the West is we say, here's this thing I know about Christianity, and we assume it must be true of every other culture. All religions teach the same thing, at least the one I read does. That's the quote, Steve Turner, British poet. It just was not the case in the ancient world. that humility, defined as using your power for the sake of others, willing to lower yourself, to remove your honour, and so on, for the sake of others, was regarded as a virtue. In fact, the very word humility, in both its Greek and Latin roots, was a negative word. It meant to be crushed, pushed down low. Now, this is not to say there are not other parts of the world where people are jolly nice. I think Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, that 5th century BC prince, I would have liked to hang out with him. He certainly wouldn't have ever punched you in the head, you know. So there's something that we could say is approaching humility there in Buddhist ethics. However, the heart of Buddhist ethics is that you don't exist. There is no self. And Buddhist ethics is driven by the practice of you not existing. To act selfishly, that is to act as if you have a self, is problematic because it traps you in this world of suffering. So the goal is to remove all sense of self and therefore to act selflessly, selflessly, but only because you need to practice non-self so that you can escape this suffering world. And although that may have results that look to us humble, I don't think anyone actually wants to live humble like that. The humility that has entered the Western culture, and yeah, I will say absolutely uniquely, and this is a point of wide agreement amongst ancient historical scholars. The idea of humility that entered our culture was that you do have a self, and everyone else has a self, and they are immeasurably valuable selves, but each of us is to use our gifts and goods and power for the sake of others. So it is a unique idea.
This is a synthesizing question, but is there a common theme in the mistakes that the church has been making throughout history? How do they kind of continue to get it wrong?
Yeah, there are big things. I mean, you notice we didn't do a comprehensive treatment of 2,000 years of history. But we did do a thematic and indicative presentation. And it's absolutely repeated. We could have chosen any number of things. I mean, the way we chose this were big themes of religion and violence, human value, charity, humility, power and humility. There were heaps of things we could have chosen and have done actually in the rest of it, which you're going to check out after this, if you're interested. But it is, these sort of human failings seem to be, they have a sort of sameness to them, don't they? Cruelty and selfishness and a lack of generosity, lack of compassion. As well as, you know, you set that against this ethic that sort of draws you towards something better than yourself. I think that's a common thing. That you see right throughout that history. But one thing I'd say is Christian groups have tended to do well when they haven't been super close to the seat of power. I do think that's a pretty common thing as you read the history.
Which is pretty tragic given that the centrepiece of the Christian faith is that God entered the world and gave himself a cross for you. I mean, whether or not you believe that's a true thing, that's meant to be the idea animating the whole Christian life. And so when Christians are grasping after power, it is a special tragedy.
Someone's asked about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Is that essentially a religious conflict with a political cloaking, as in Northern Ireland? Any comments on that?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of religion in that one. However, if you know the history of the state of Israel in the last 100 years, you'll know that an astonishing thing happened with the world's approval in 1948. The British had run what they call Palestine, or you know, what is now the state of Israel, had run it for decades. And that was problematic enough But after the Second World War and the treatment of Jews in Europe, there was a collective sense of guilt at the treatment of the Jews. And so calls for a Jewish homeland that had been going since the late 1800s really came to fever pitch when they discovered what had happened in the Holocaust. And it was really the Holocaust that made the world community say there must be a Jewish state. And the only logical Jewish state is that place that Britain now runs under the British man. And so the Brits pulled out, and in 1948, it was, with the world's authority, outside of Islamic nations, handed over to the Jewish people. And as a result, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people were instantly dispersed in 1948 to make room. And there was a huge flood of European Jews into the state of Israel. And I get what the world was trying to pull off there. And it makes sense if we were all cast back into 1945 to 1948. But it really was pushing Arabs, who were mostly Muslims, but many of whom were actually Christian Arabs, it just pushed them out into refugee camps or into new cluster cities. And so from then it really was a give us our land back. Well, but it's our land from ancient times, and we were treated so badly. No, we want our land back. And so that's where the escalating thing comes from. And the fact that the people who got the land are of one religion, and the people who were in the land for 300 years before that, because the Turks have run it long before that, 800 years of pretty consistent Islamic rule. It has been overlaid with religion. It's essentially land, but it's powerfully motivated by the religious differences between the two.
So there's no denying that there's religion all involved and entangled in it, and yet there's a historical
It isn't about the church, because the church isn't involved in that conflict. And nor are we trying to say religion is never involved in conflict. We are saying Northern Ireland conflict has almost nothing to do with religion. But we're happy to concede that the Crusades had quite a bit to do with religion. And hopefully you've seen that we've tried to treat that fairly.
Someone has asked about the Middle Ages and the abuses of the power through the church in that time. You have anything to say about that? Didn't cover all of that?
Well, we couldn't get it all in, but there's some pretty dire chapters, aren't there, in that period, where it seems everything's bad. What the relatively poor fishermen following Jesus around trying to serve people looks very different in that context. I mean, I've got a friend who's a Christian, actually appeared in the documentary. He says he finds it hard to believe anyone can study, for instance, Reformation history and still be a Christian, seeing how the way people treated each other. And so there are huge periods of dreadful history. I hope we've conveyed some of that. And yet, even while that's happening, there's some great stuff happening alongside it too.
That's important to point out. 99.9% of people know nothing about the Middle Ages. And they call it the Dark Ages, which no medievalist ever called it, because it wasn't a Dark Age. And so most of what we've picked up about what was going on there is invented or based on isolated events that we've sort of turned into the whole story. And it just isn't true. I mean, there were terrible things, no denying, but there were also reformations. So in 8th, 9th century, south of France, where the papal power was, the Catholic Church was centered in the south of France, opulent beyond belief, terrible opulence. But then some priest wakes up one morning and goes, oh, this is terrible. This doesn't look like what Jesus called, and called for a great reformation that transformed Europe and gave us, you know, these welfare charities and monastic movements that cared for the poor for the next 150 years. And then there was another time of opulence. And then there's been reform and disappointment, through the whole thing. But I will also throw this in. Probably the most extreme example of the medieval evils of the church would be the Spanish Inquisition. where people were tortured and killed for having heretical views and so on. It's absolutely awful and inexcusable. But three times more people were executed in 9 months of the secular French Revolution than in the entire 350-year Spanish Inquisition. 17,000 people executed in 9 months in the name of secular liberty. And no one's walking the streets of Brisbane tonight going, oh, woe to the French for their French Revolution. How violent are the French? Or woe to secular liberty. No, we don't do that, but we do with the Spanish Inquisition. So I just think historical perspective really counts here.
You've honed in on Jesus' teaching of love. Why that teaching? Jesus taught about all sorts of different things. Why have you picked on that?
Well, it's pretty key. it seems like it did teach a lot of these. Almost all of those other things flow out of this. The whole Jesus story is a great love story, isn't it? Of God's love for humanity. God's going to great lengths to give life and then find ways of restoring the relationship. I mean, we read the Old Testament, people often, it gets a bit of a bad rap these days, but when you read it in a big chunk, all you can see is this theme of God over and over again reaching out to people who keep connecting. I think there's a beauty to that. So yeah, God, love's pretty
big. Well, and there's evidence you'll find if you read one of the biographies of Jesus, what people call Gospels, you'll find he was one day asked, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment?" And Jesus said, "That's simple. Love God with all your heart and love your neighbour as yourself." So, I mean, just on the evidence that we have, Jesus said love is the centre. And as Simon pointed out, the whole narrative of Jesus' life is that he displayed that love of neighbour and even love of enemy in giving himself on a cross. If you've read the Gospels, you know there's quite a bit of this love teaching from Jesus, but the whole thing moves toward the climax where chapter after chapter is about his arrest, trial, crucifixion, burial, resurrection. So what I'm saying is, it isn't an arbitrary teaching of Jesus to say love is important. It's actually the shape of the whole life of Jesus and giving himself on behalf of others.
So you haven't just cherry-picked one of Jesus' teaching and ignored the whole
thing? I don't think anyone who reads a gospel, the only first century biographies we have of Jesus, could come away with any other conclusion than that love is the centre of his vision.
Moving to a personal question for both of you. After you've done this and confronted some of the worst things, but also some of the good things Christians have done, are you more or less encouraged by being a Christian and a kind of an advocate for Christianity? What has been the effect on you?
It's both. I guess we might say this, but excuse me, it's both of those things. It's both discouraging and encouraging. There's a part of me that isn't as surprised by the history as others might be, just because I'm sort of so conscious of my own failings. And so if you think you put that onto the whole population of people who've ever claimed to be Christian and think they're going to mess it up, it's not all that surprising. So there's a part of me that thinks, yeah, I get why this is going to happen. I'm also very conscious of the deeply human element of anyone who's ever claimed to be Christian, and the way that they kind of fail over and over again, but nonetheless, somehow, often persists in a way that draws them towards a vision of life that's better than they would have been otherwise. Oh, I guess I've seen that over my own life in church communities that I've been a part of that are often not spectacular, but there's something often beautiful in what it can do, and I think for a person. And that's been my experience personally, and also as I've read the history. So some of these great figures that we've highlighted, even in this portion of the documentary, are all flawed characters too. They're really flawed characters, and yet what they're trying to do, and at their best moments, they're living out something that, that really is kind of a compelling vision of what human life can be. So, yeah, it's been a good part for me.
The documentary experience really has flattened me in many ways. I don't know that I was ever really a triumphalist Christian, but I certainly am not now. Because Jesus said, you know, take the log out of your eye. Don't go looking at the speck in other people's. And making this documentary has really been a 3-year journey of trying to look at the log in the church's eye. But at the same time, I'm more convinced than ever that the most beautiful thing ever given to world history is the idea that God loves you so much he entered the world in Christ and gave himself for you. And that being the heart of Christianity, I'm more a fan of Christianity than I've ever been.
We're going to have one more question. But before we get to the final question for both of them, love for you to take a moment to provide some feedback. You can see a URL to go and give us some feedback. You can do that on mobiles. We'll also send out that link as well. Let me just highlight a few things in that feedback form. If you were to do that, you can tick a box to find out more about the City Bible Forum and our activities. You can also find out more about the Center for Public Christianity that put on this documentary. There's also there an opportunity if you'd like to investigate the tune for yourself. If you would like, either by yourself or in a group, to investigate more of the things that you've been hearing, and you can say whether you'd like us to contact you by text or email or give you a phone call to help you to do that. There's also one option in that feedback to get just one email, one follow-up email only, not ongoing emails for the rest of your life, but one only, where you will be given links and further information about how to go deeper in some of the things, and links to the Centre for Public Christianity's site with other videos that you can watch as well. So that is one of the options in the feedback as well. If you would like to read some of the tune about Jesus' life for yourself, we do have free copies in the foyer of one of the early first century biographies of Jesus' life called Luke's Gospel. And it's available there for free if you'd like to take that home and read it. We also have some books out there that you might like to purchase as well, so please feel free to look at those. So, all of those things over and done with now. Final question to both John and Simon. If someone said, I like this beautiful tune, I like the cello piece, was it Bach? Was it Bach? Bach. Beautiful tune, but it's irrelevant who wrote it. What's to say it's not the same with Jesus? Why don't we take his beautiful tune that he gave us to love others and then get rid of Jesus? How would you answer that?
Yeah, I mean, people could try that. And one of the things we try to convey here is that there is a beautiful tune and it's worth considering and looking at and thinking about what the impact of it's been. We, it's no surprise, I guess, happen to also think there's something true in this story. And so we're compelled by that. And so in a sense, it matters a lot to me, for instance, if it happens to be true. One of my frustrations is that this story is not taken so seriously that it's either kind of rejected, you know, angrily or looked at more seriously. I love C.S. Lewis's treatment of this when he says that the story of Jesus, and particularly the resurrection, can only be of absolute importance or of no importance whatsoever. The one thing it can't be is moderately important. And I think a lot of people in our culture think of this as either maybe moderately important, but not enough to kind of dive into. What do you think has the ring of truth to it, that is a much more significant thing. So that's my own sense of this, that considering whether or not it happens to be true is a vital question.
So if Christianity is false, it's of no importance. If it's true, of infinite importance, but the only thing it can't be is moderately important. So you're convinced that it's true, and therefore
of ultimate importance.
Well, I think believing in the love ethic without believing in the basis behind it is still better than nothing. I mean, I'd rather hang out with people who just happen to think love is a good thing than people who reckon it's not. So, you know, so I mean, if you know, the secular humanist, you know, love, compassion, equality ethic, oh, it's fine, fantastic, all power to you. But I think it does matter if the Jesus stuff is true, because what's to stop anyone waking up one morning and going, hang on, who said love is the key? I don't happen to believe that. If any of you know anything about the 19th century atheist philosopher, perhaps the most influential European philosopher of the modern world, Friedrich Nietzsche, he actually woke up one morning, and it was a long process of academic reflection, and said, hang on, God's not real, and Jesus certainly didn't die on a cross for our sins, that's made up, and that has sent our world down a dodgy path for the last 1900 years, where we've all thought the center of the universe is loving the weak and caring for the poor, and he said, that is ridiculous. No one in ancient Greece and Rome thought that. The classical ethics said, and he was quite right about this, he was a classicist as well as a philosopher. The classical philosopher said, no, nature intends the weak and deformed to be discarded, and intends for the strong and the talented to flourish. That's what we need. And Nietzsche actually made a full-scale argument that the most sickening thing in Europe was Christian compassion. Now, here's the thing. He was far more logical than today's secular humans. Because he said, no God, no intention behind the universe. There's no such thing as love. There's just human behavior, and humanity will be better off if we let the strong flourish and the weak fall away. Really hard to argue against. Now, I'm glad secular humanists don't go down his track, but his track was terribly logical, fiercely rational. And so, in the end, I think it matters if at the center of the universe there's a God of deep love and humility and self-sacrifice, because that makes logical lives of love and humility and self-sacrifice. If there is no order and intention, no love at the center of the universe, then love and compassion are just feelings. And we may or may not want them. So for me, it matters that it's real, that God is like that.
Would you please join me in thanking John and Simon for coming?